Thank you. 1 Corinthians, as I was saying, concerning marriage. Concerning marriage. 1 Epistle to the Corinthians, we're in chapter 7. This is a major division in the outline. This is in answer to their letter. They wrote him a letter. Those days you found somebody headed that way and you handed that letter to him and he delivered it. But they had some questions. So the question, the problem here is the problem of marriage and celibacy. Celibacy is the practice of not being married, though you could be. Verses 1 to 9. In verse 1, the approval of the celibate life. Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, the word good, it is good, is kalos, the word for good that emphasizes beautiful, in harmony, or approved. We would translate it perhaps appropriate. It is appropriate for a man not to touch. And the word touch, it comes from the root meaning to fasten. This is not a gentle touch to guide the lady to her seat. This is sensual or sexual touching. So he says, if you can do it, it is good to dedicate your life to God and to the ministry and leave women alone. Celibacy. Dedicate your life. Consider it a marriage devotion just to God. Then the instructions concerning the married life. The reason marriage is preferable to celibacy. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication. He brings up that not everyone has the gift of celibacy. It takes a real gift, that ability to just focus on doing the things of God, be ready to pick up and move at any moment, you know. To pursue celibacy while burning with lust is foolish. Now, A.T. Robertson elaborates that this is not the only reason to get married, just because you can't avoid fornication. It is not the only reason for marriage, but it is a true one. The main purpose of marriage is children, in his opinion. Mutual love is another. The family is the basis of all civilization. Paul does not give a low view of marriage, but is merely answering questions put to him about life in Corinth. So the reason marriage is preferable. Then the nature of the marriage relationship. Let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. The Greek didn't have a word for wife and husband. So what this is saying is, let every man have his own woman, let every woman have her own man. So, but used in that way, that's what they meant. The general rule, then, is for men and women to get married. John Calvin adds, this passage is also opposed to polygamy, being married to more than one husband, marrying more than one wife. For the apostle desires that every woman have her own husband, intimating that the obligation is mutual. So only one apiece. Then the duties in the marriage relation. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. This is a very important rule. This is rules about what it means to be married. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. The husband has power of the body of the wife. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. This takes a little bit of getting into. Due benevolence in this context refers to proper and consistent sexual intimacy. He states the principle that the wife does not have authority over her own body. This whole thing about you're on the couch tonight or something, you know, that type of thing, is not Christian. The husband also does not have authority over his body. The marriage partner has the authority. So this is a way of thinking so different from the way we think about sexual relationships today. Today's culture treats sex as a pleasure-gaining activity. But in Christianity, marriage is all about the other one, not about you. It's not about how I feel, it's about how you feel. So you are not held accountable for pleasing yourself if you do not have the authority over your own body. That's not my job, to please myself. Clearly, the husband's only goal in sexual activity is to please his wife. You have to get your mind around that. And the wife's goal is to please the husband. This is where the individual authority lies. Then he speaks about the mutual regulation of sex relations. He now cautions the other way, defraud not ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency, your inability to hold. But I speak this by permission and not of commandment. So defrauding, what does that mean here? Is promising something that you do not keep. You don't keep your promise to somebody. Defrauding. Marriage promises sexual intimacy. It is not proper for the individual to withhold what has been promised. Not your authority over your body. You don't get to say when. See? The one exception is made for the time of fasting. Now, I'm going to just guess that that's not really a thing that you and I deal with very much. It can be. Christian fasting is something that I have done and my wife has done. My son and his wife do it on a regular basis. President Dennis, for a long time at least, fasted every Monday, just one day. I've often mentioned that if you fast, start thinking of it as the Hebrew day. The Hebrew day starts at sunset. So you have the evening and the morning is one day. So if you're going to stop fasting, if you're going to stop eating, if you're going to fast for one day, then have your breakfast and your lunch, but begin your fast before supper. Continue the fast for next day's breakfast and lunch, and then don't gorge yourself, but have a nice supper the next day. And doing this, it almost seems like, well, that went by really fast. See? So the desire for food declines when you're fasting more than one day. I fasted for a week, and by the end of the week, I had stopped being hungry and felt like I could just coast. I thought I could do this another week, but there's complications in this day and age. If you're not eating, you know, you're only drinking water, you can't meet somebody for lunch, you know, all these things. It's just inconvenient. So I just stayed with the 1 week. But what happens is your body, in a week's time, your body is normally getting its energy off the food that you put in your stomach. And this is taking essentially the sugar out and energizing that. Well, when you stop eating, then the body craves that sugar, craves that quick energy. When it doesn't get it, the body's metabolism or something changes around and it starts drawing off, dare I say, the fat of the land. And that's what fat is, stored energy. So you can fast for a long time, depending on how much you got stored up, you see. And that is quite fulfilling. You don't lack, you don't need, and works out very well. So as the days passed, I was not quite as hungry. But the other thing was that the desire for sexual relations also dries up. This is one of the reasons to fast, by the way, to bring your body under subjection. Get a hold on the cravings, you see, for food, for sex, so on. So if either husband or wife intends to fast, he says that permission should be gained from the one who has authority over the body. You get permission from your wife, you get permission from your husband. And with the permission comes the permission to withhold sexual relations for the time being. This would be saying to your husband, I'm going to be fasting. Therefore, though you get to call the shots on the sexual relationship, I can't really enter into the good partnership in this. And so I would appreciate getting a pass on this, you see. So Paul urges that this arrangement be only temporary, since it puts the non-fasting partner into a condition of heightened temptation. This is not a commandment, he says, but a recommendation for the good of the spiritual life and the marriage relationship. So a lot in a few words here, but that's the concept behind it. Then third, the recognition of both marriage and celibacy as proper. He says, now before we lose our meaning of what this is all about, for I would that all men were even as I myself, and this means not married. But every man hath his proper gift of God. Not all have the gift of celibacy, the drive that says I'm going to be doing the things of God and it's going to take up all my time. One after this manner and another after that. So not everybody has the same gifts. So it's quite possible that Paul was once married. The story about him being in the Sanhedrin, or one of the main groups, one of the rules back then was that you were married. So it could quite well be that he had been married, but at the time of the writing, he was not. And so we can guess what happened. His wife died or whatever, you know. He found that his ministry to evangelize the world around him was all-consuming. He had no time for a wife and did not desire to be sidetracked. He cautions that not all men have that gift of celibacy and should not try to pretend to have it. We were made aware a while back in a ministry that one of the people in the ministry wanted to be like the main man in the ministry and not get married. But he didn't have that gift, and it turns out he was having secret relations with other women in the ministry. And it was a bad thing. Part of his repentance was to resign the position and so on. So it doesn't do any good to pretend. Then the advice of the apostle to the unmarried. I say, therefore, to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. Stay unmarried. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. Well, this burning, of course, is the same thing as not being able to contain yourself sexually. Paul urges honesty with your own heart. Can you be fulfilled with full-time Christian service, or will you, here's the alternate, burn in lust over the people to whom you should be ministering? You see, there's just terrible problem brewing there.